thank you. Basically, in the summer, that of July, August, and September, we would call them our summer sessions. We are here today on the 22nd for our Sunday discussions, which we are studying in the Secret Doctrine, and we are doing that Volume 1, the Proem. Next Sunday, we will be continuing on page 10 through page 13. And then, as a reminder, in August, we will have no Sunday meetings. And those meetings start at 11 a.m. and they're over at 12 noon, and the doors open at 10:30. Now, on Wednesdays, for most of us are familiar, we are having our study class from 7:45 to 9 p.m. in the Bhagavad Gita. Also on Wednesday evenings, from 5:30 to 7:30, the reference library is open for one may go in and look into any other subjects they might be interested in. And basically, that's about it, since we don't have anything in August, but we will start up again on September 2nd, continuing with this program, and we'll carry it all the way through till the end of September. Now, most of us that are here today are familiar with the work that's done by any ULT lodge, whether it's situated here or abroad. They're basically a platform for expressing this philosophy, this ancient philosophy of theosophy. Each place that one may go, it is autonomous, but yet we all have that same basic aim, purpose, and teaching. And again, aim to spread broadcast the teachings for the purpose of any individual who might be searching or looking for answers that he hasn't or she hasn't found anywhere else. And yet, this philosophy is but a small smidgen, shall we say, of the ancient philosophies that are situated and have been carried on down through the ages, the same basic universal teachings. It asks of anyone who is interested in this to feel free to take part by asking questions, making comments on any subject matter that we happen to be discussing of that time. And for each one of us, if we search hard enough, we will start to search for that true interest within ourselves, because it states that it is our inner knowing more than our outer knowing that we need to take control of. And that the fact that each one can make of himself a student or an inquirer, it's up to the individual. And it also brings up points in the declaration that we wanted to mention. It's very short, we'll read it, only to go through it again because it's very short, but it's very poignant and it's very direct for us to understand. When it states, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self and a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situation, is that similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So for something that has stood this long of time and stayed the same, it has something to express and something to give and something to take. So each one can make that choice on his own. Now, in today's section that we're going to be having summarized, we are going to start to get a hint of some of the basic essential that are important in understanding how to study the secret doctrine. And this proem for an introduction is quite lengthy, but it gives certain keys that we're going to need when we start to really take up this study of the secret doctrine and how. So we will have this part summarized, and then afterwards we'll have a time period for questions and comments and discussion.
If you've had the time to read it, you know this is dense. And we mean that in a positive way. The Orthodox Brahmins accept the death of Brahma, the creator, at the end of every age of Brahma, which is 100 years, which takes 15 figures in our time to describe it. They see that as a temporary disappearance from manifestation or a periodical rest. But because of the ideas of the Advaitis, they consider them atheists. The occultists, however, agree with the Advaita Vedantins, who say that absolute unity cannot pass into infinity, for the one all is like space, which is the only mental and physical representation on earth. It's not an object or subject to perception, space. If one could suppose that the infinite, eternal all, that omnipresent unity, instead of being in eternity, becoming periodically a manifold universe or a multiple personality, that unity would cease to be. Now, a quote. Space is neither a limitless void nor a conditioned fullness, but both. May we repeat that? Space is neither a limitless void nor a conditioned fullness, but both. Being on the plane of absolute abstraction, the ever incognizable deity, which is void only to finite minds, and on that of myopic perception, the plenum, the absolute container of all that is, whether manifested or unmanifested, it is, therefore, that absolute all. What is that which was, is, and will be, whether there is a universe or not, whether there be gods or none, asked the esoteric Senzar Catechism, and the answer made is space. End quote. Brahma, the unmanifested, is that universe in abscondita, or hidden. The very names of the two chief deities, Brahma and Vishnu, have esoteric meanings. Brahma, with the accent over the top, the manifested is the Logos, made male-female in the symbolical orthodox dogmas. Vishnu, from the root vis, to pervade, to enter into the nature of the essence. Thus, Brahma, Vishnu, being this infinite space of which the gods, the rishis, the manus, and all in this universe are simply the potencies. Manu's account of the Brahma separating his body into male and female compares with the esotericism of chapters 2, 3, and 4 of Genesis. So you might want to pick up the Bible and go back and read those chapters. They're esoteric. However, it is not atheism, as the Orthodox Brahmins declare it. It's not the one unknown, ever-present God in nature that is rejected, but the God of human dogma, which has been shaped by man. The occultist accepts revelation as coming from divine, yet still finite beings. The manifested lives, never from the unmanifestable one life, but from those entities called primordial man, Dhyani Buddhas, Dhyan Shohans, the Elohim, or sons of God, the planetary spirits of all nations. Space, however, as the unknown causeless cause, is the oldest dogma in occultism.
Now, briefly, if we've noticed, we've started to touch, even though of the ancient teachings, of somewhat part of the philosophy of theosophy, being that we're starting to look at that deific principle as it was brought down through the ages and different religions and different philosophies down till today. So if we do touch upon this, and for those of you who might have checked with the references, we're starting to delve in to things that for most of the students is very familiar. So do we have any questions or comments? Yes.
With these definitions on the first page of Brahma and Vishnu, mm-hmm. to grow or to expand and to pervade, can we then see a correspondence to Atma and Bhuti in the sense that Atma is called forward, buoy being its vehicle, or to pervade meaning to be the essence of. So is there a correspondence there between Brahma and Vishnu and Atman?
We could say that to the extent that one is, shall we say, the is, where the other is the vehicle of the is, as we state with, when we look at the man and the seven principles within us, we look at that part of it that is the vehicle, is the container of it in this manifestation. And the other, the higher, that is just is. Yes.
Just as long as we don't think that Atma means the absolute. People often do, though. It's spirit and spiritual soul. But as spirit, it is a manifestation from within that absolute. So there's always that space beyond or that absolute all.
Yes, and we can all acknowledge that point when we even just think of the idea of space. Can any of us actually say that they know of a place that space is not, that there is an end to space or a beginning to space? Is this with this?
Yes.
Yes.
I often have a feeling there's an empty space in my head.
And yet, something's in there collecting, and something's in there recording. Yes. Pralaya is a period of rest, shall we say, and it does exist, but what is there of us to know of it, which we can't really, but the fact is, it is there, whether it's in a waking state or a sleeping state. Space is always there, whether we can acknowledge it or we can't acknowledge it. It is there. Yes.
If space didn't contain Pralaya, how could anything ever wake up?
Do we understand what we're saying here? That in that time period where there is no manifestation, as we are on this plane now, that there is a, shall we say, a gathering and held into a time period of rest. And then through vibrations, there comes a pulling apart and the period of rest is over and there will become a reawakening of that which was, and hopefully on a higher plane. Yes.
Space is really pervasive in our minds, not only in the movies, but way back in one of the Star Trek series, there was an episode where the edge of space had been charted, and beyond it no one had gone, because they assumed there would be nothingness. And the Enterprise decided it needed to, for whatever the reason was, go past that limit. And of course, it found itself in a different universe, etc., etc., but the idea being we are always impelled to push beyond the limits of what we accept as the end of, in this case, space, or the end of an idea we are eternally pushed forward.
In a vast general, we could look at that as evolution. It's like, no. We're always looking for more. There's got to be more to this than what I can see or what I don't understand. I've got to be able to understand it. But there's a drive within mankind always to push onward, to push forward. And yet there's a part of our nature within that vehicle that we spoke of earlier, that part of our nature, that Buddhi nature, that has within it all we have experienced and learned. We need to tap into that, but we can't tap into it when we only exist on what we see and feel and can touch. There is a deeper part of our nature we need to work into. You had a point?
I'm confused about, you know, the separation to the male-female polarities. I had heard somewhere that space itself is a metaphor for, you know, the female polarity of what is, because it's like the womb of the universe. And so I don't really know what that means when we divide into the polarities of male and female.
When that idea of dividing between male and female, if we look at the history of what we understand in the secret doctrine, when we speak of the races, there were races prior to the race that we're in now, the Aryan race, where there was, shall we say, no sex at all. It was in
the,
pardon?
Hermaphroditic.
The hermaphrodite. I hadn't got to that part yet. Okay, so we would say in the idea of no sex, that they're the pure spirit that first entered onto this plane of evolution was pure spirit. And then as the race develops and goes around in developing through the rounds and races that we have spoken of earlier in the ocean classes, there is a development where from the hermaphrodite there is a split, and we now have male and female. Now, our understanding is this happened at the fourth race. The three and a half going from the third race into the fourth. There was a split, and there was male and female. Eventually, when we go back, just like we see this solid form that we could touch and feel today, as we keep evolving back to what we were and making the full development of the rounds with the races, there will be a race of where we physically don't need physical bodies as we now know them, that all communication would be on a higher plane, a mental plane of consciousness. So this is just sort of touching on the main idea that what from the one to the none to the split to we are now. It's these are stages of evolution and development. And for most of us, there is in a male, there is sometimes a touch of a female's way of thinking, and vice versa, of for females to have that male way of thinking. We can see that especially today. Yes.
Well, we think that the idea of space itself is neither male nor female.
Correct.
It's neuter, right? That it is the plenum. It says here in our part that plenum, the container of all. So in that sense, it is the womb.
Right. In that
right?
sense,
in that
you could.
Sense. So when we look at it, we have to look at it as universally as we possibly can imagine, rather than the particular. So we understand the fundamental principle that it's trying to convey to us, that it is neither a limitless void or a conditioned fullness. I think it's similar to what we've heard in some Buddhist texts, that the world is empty and has no meaning. We as gods fill it up and give it.
Yes, dear.
Well, we're not sure what the questioner had in mind, the original questioner about space, but we think that we're often given, there's an analogy of the waters of space. And water is considered feminine, So things are coming out of space. There is, it is, of course, the deity, which we will never understand. So it's, we can only understand it by saying what it's not, really, rather than what it is. It is.
That just and that's it. What we can it say is. It is.
We were behind a car this week, and the license plate said "just is." And we thought, like, oh, space. It just is. It
just is.
But there's the waters of space. And if water is female, then things are coming out of space. So we could say that there's a feminine quality about it, about that, not it itself, but that the second level of creation, which is above the manifested forms. You know, the first level of creation, like the word coming forth before any forms, that archetypical.
All right, however each individual has to try to visualize this for himself. And to really think about it, it's asking us to stretch our mind on a metaphysical level, that which is not really that solid to us at this point. But it does make one sort of stretch their mind to understand it. Yes?
There is a simpler way to look at it. Even when we say, in the beginning, there was the word, there had to be the speaker,
right,
which we'll say was spirit. But once that word is expressed, you have duality. You have spirit and matter. You have the manifestation of spirit, which is just like saying, if I have an idea, that's a manifestation in my mind, but I can bring it forth onto the physical plane.
Yes.
It's always spirit and matter, and that relates male and female. In order for the thinker to have a full experience on this plane, there must be that duality. So if you're happy being a male now, do it very well, because you will be female and you will suffer as you have treated women. Equally for the women, we make the conditions that we will suffer later if we're not behaving responsibly. So male and female is a necessity.
In this whole great vast period of evolution. Yes, Beth.
If we were thinking, if we view it as opposed to male and female as further differentiation. We know on a cellular level there are some creatures that self-regenerate. I don't know if amoebas still do it or not. On some level there are creatures, is all we can call them, that don't need that differentiation to self-regenerate. But at some point in our evolution, for further contrast and work and ability to learn more, we needed that separation or further differentiation to continue this work. And at some point we'll go back to that state of non-differentiation and then finally back to the one spirit.
Nicely put. Yes, you had a point way in the back?
I think we have to differentiate between the general principle, the male and female principle, like in the original space, and the specific gender, separation into gender in the process of evolution. That happened at a point in the evolution that gender manifested. But in as has been expressed, in the original, the space, there was always a male and female principle. But it was not manifest as separate entities as being
spirit.
Spirit merit, as we said earlier, yes. That's another understanding. It's one pole, but one end is spirit, one end is matter. It's all one. So it's like the idea, the hand, the front and the back. it's one, but it has two sides. You had a point?
Yeah, it's talking about the male female thing too. And it hit me some time ago that I have both of them in me. Mm. You know, I'm male and female. But it took a long time for me to recognize that, that you know, that I came from a mother and a father. And, you know, I am male and female, given that the physical part that they were tagged me for. But, you know, I understand it.
I think it's brought out more in today's world than, let's go back 100 years ago. I mean, the male was the male and the female was the female, and they were two separate things. And yet, when we come to the idea of feelings and sentiment, we have different ways of expressing it. But again, it's the one with that duality within. Yes.
Well, we haven't gotten to it yet, but we're studying the Gita. And number one, what does the word matter imply? Spirit and matter are one initially. But when it came time for Krishna to bring forth the new period, he said, I am the Father who provides the seed. My own Maya, and that is called a mystic power of self-ideation in all of nature, which is mine. So we get an idea here of the separation. The beginning of manifestation requires a womb to sow the seed, and it's stated that man knows his mother before
you know it's the father. Mm. Yes,
yeah. Yes, just that we should always remember the soul, ourselves, as thinkers. We are genderless and have the potential for the fullest expression of either the masculine or the feminine. A student many years ago asked, why are the adepts always mentioned as male? And the answer given was, perhaps men need the example more than women. And in one way, it is said to become an adept, one needs more of the responsive, sensitive, compassionate nature that is usually found in the female. However, we are both, both.
That settles that part. We are both, both. We could remember that way in the back.
Can we ask a question on the reference?
Oh. Okay.
On the back page, where it starts, what would be the nature of the one absolute?
Yes, second paragraph.
Yes. The ending to that, it says, since it cannot be limited from the one absolute reality or conditioned, yeah, it cannot have any relation or connection with whatever is manifested, limited, or conditioned. So it's talking about that it needs something to connect it. And it says such a relationship would necessarily limit that which is limitless and non-conditioned. So we would wonder, we assume that they're talking about Manas here as the connection between the unmanifested to the manifested. And why, and we were always under the impression that spirit is and that it can't be changed. Yet it's talking about the relationship would limit the limitless and the unconditioned. And we were wondering how that could be.
Wait, is that?
I just think there's a bit of confusion in the question, because it's that the one absolute cannot be expressed. It can't be in any form, it can't be in any limited when we say the absolute, we can't think spirit. Spirit is an expression along with matter of the absolute.
Does that clarify that idea?
Yeah.
Yeah, because sometimes we do notice in the beginning when we're learning about the seven principles within, and we keep thinking of separating that which is. You can't really separate something that just is. It's that connection that we try to make, and that's what we think confuses us, because most all of us has been through that we have to understand that is what we're looking at is far beyond what we just see in that principles within man. Yes.
Well, one of the problems, or the many problems we have in trying to understand this, is that it says in the footnote on the first page of Studying the Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, Proem, at the bottom of the page there, it says, matter is dual in religious metaphysics and septenary and esoteric teachings, like everything else in the universe. So until we have those keys, we're going to be really confused, we think.
True, but then again, it's really interesting that some of all these major ideas that we have within this, it's sort of trying to help us understand when we speak of the idea, for instance, of the space, that unknown causeless cause. It is the oldest, quote, doctrine, shall we say, in occultism. It is something that has always been there, that unknown, ceaseless cause. Then it breaks it down into the part that's manifested and then the time period when it's unmanifested. It explains to us the duality in developing, that once we come into the form, the vehicle that we're using, there is going to be a duality in that principle within us as the way we think, whether we think on higher altruistic universal metaphysics or whether we deal with more everyday, lower, dense ideas of matter. For most of us, we're sort of caught up in this matter, and it's difficult to look at these ideas, and yet these ideas can be the key parts to get us thinking in other directions. Yes?
And just quickly at the bottom there, at the very last sentence on that page, it says, Parabrahman is an unconditioned and absolute reality, and that Mula Prakriti, which is the root of nature,
right,
is sort of a veil thrown over it. So that's as close as we can get in our conceptions, as the root of nature is a veil thrown over that which we can never cognize.
And we could look at it, our personalities that we live in daily is the opposite of the true individuality that we really are. So we could see that balance in that. Yes.
So something with a veil over it is a mystery and something for us to try to work out,
to understand, yes.
Is there male and female spirits? And if so, which one am I?
Is there male and female spirits, and which one am I?
Yeah, just because I'm a male, that means I'm a male spirit.
I don't understand what you mean by have a male spirit. Yes?
Well, if we wanted to know our identity spiritually, whether we're male or female, we are neither, but we are both. Okay? It's the same as this conception of the absolute. We are neither, but we are both. So that the qualities which we show are those which are the attributes or the faculties which we have developed over the number of
undeveloped. And also the fact we have to think of in each lifetime, when we look at ourselves and really look at ourselves, we have to understand the karmic causes when we look at ourselves. And you can sort of balance yourself out by really looking at yourself and finding out what's obviously, we just know. We know without having to read about it, having someone tell us about it. Intuitively, we just know certain things. Other things we don't possibly understand, or we can't get the gist of it. Maybe those karmically are situations that we need to learn about. So it's everything that we have in any one lifetime is something that we have created in past lifetimes that's being expressed as best it can at this time in the vehicle that we're now using as the human form. So you can just, it's like that idea of a pitcher of water. You can just put so much water into a glass, it's going to overflow eventually. So there's just so much karmic, shall we say, matter, deeds that we have to balance out or try to balance out in any one lifetime. So you really can't tell, other than maybe understanding within yourself how you feel about things and what you know about things and what you don't know about things. So that can explain, just as a more direct sense, about each one in each lifetime what we are, way in the back.
But the fact is, the vehicle I'm using can be male or female.
True.
Or it might even be hermaphrodite. There are already thousands of children born every year where the parents or the doctor will make a choice of which gender it's going to be. So it's already beginning that return. However, the fact is, as a thinker, as a spiritual being, we have no gender. I'm
That's
not male,
true.
I'm not female. I'm capable of learning and experiencing in either one, but I am neither.
So again, we're judging by what we see on the outside, not what we know within us. Yes?
The statement, I'm not either male or female, is maybe, let's call it intellectually so, it's truth. But is there a part of us, each and every, all of us, which is modified by the awareness that we are either male or female, that will condition that statement that we're not. If we want to, we accept it with our minds directly, intellectually, but isn't there something, I don't know, it's a buzzword, unconscious maybe, but it bubbles up from the unconscious that we are an awareness, male or female, that will still color that concept some.
Well, if we look at it really basically and just say that I am I, consciousness, I am I, does it matter if I is one or the other from the outer? The fact that we know, it's just like someone that has amnesia, they might not remember who they are, where they've been, where they've come from, why this happened. All they know is I. Who am I? Where am I? That consciousness is neither, in a way, male or female. It's is. And to a higher extent, they're what we speak about as universal consciousness, the highest of highest. So it is a thing that's neither or. It just is. Yes.
In manifestation, it is either male or female. It is either left or right. It is hot or cold. I mean, it's ideation is male. Materialization is female. It's universal manifestation. You know, the Chinese have yin and yang. I mean, everything has those qualities of either being hard or being soft, being light or being dark, being sweet or being sour. It's just the world of opposites that, in one sense of the manifestation, we see it as a male and female gender for the furtherment of evolution of these vehicles. So it's just an expression, but it's an expression that's found everywhere in the universe.
True, and on here we keep saying manifestation. There's where the duality comes. There's where the balance has to be made, where it can be expressed. When we have that great period of pralaya and all becomes all within the source, shall we say the universal oversoul, all is one again, that's one thing. But here on this plane is where we have the duality. And that proof of that is what we could just think with our mind. We have ways of thinking one way or another. There's that constant duality. Should I or shouldn't I? There's that little angel and that little devil trying to convince us within ourselves. There is that duality. We have to admit that to the fact we could see it. Yes?
If we go back to the symbols that we started out with in this study, if you take the one and the zero, the straight line and the circle, as Pythagoras told us, that's the perfect number, 10. But that is also male and female. We cannot escape that duality until we rise above it. It is probably most of what we would call the adepts or the wise ones or the initiates are probably hermaphrodite. When they take on a body, which they don't have to, they can live in an astral body, which again is genderless. So we just have to get over the idea of ourselves as one or the other, but possible to be either.
That is a strong point. So if we could just go back to the main idea of consciousness, as a conscious being, does it matter? Like, for instance, an actor can have different parts and different plays, wear the costumes of a woman, wear the costumes of a male. That one that's doing it, it is just is. It can be male, it can be female. It's not that important, but basically from this part, that main idea with using the idea of the space idea, of that idea of everything within this universe is absolute unity. There is a deific principle that rules with through this universe. We are just little aspects of it. Each one of us has to develop on our own.
I think that what I wanted to get at was not the specifics, male, female, in the world of manifestation, but more the principles. You bring up the idea of the deific principle. And all I can tell you is that it's obvious to me intuitively that space is a really important thing. I mean, in my previous life, whatever years ago, would only pay attention to the things in space. And now, all I know is that if I put attention on space itself, that I have a feeling a lot more is going to come out of that. And so, I think it was more that I was looking at that it is, space represents something in this world of form that is like a pearl, something that if I put attention on it, it's a window into spirit. And it has that deific principle of, you know, extending space into infinity is, you know, similarly to, you know, time and extending time into eternity. Infinity and eternity are two deific principles which time and space represent. And I was thinking of time as being male and space being female. That's what
I see. Okay. Yeah. You had a point? You forgot it.
Well, I like to think male and female more as polarities, receptive and you know, we have these natures. We all have these natures. Sometimes we're receptive, and sometimes we initiate action. And if we initiate action without reflection, then we get into trouble. We really do, if we're impulsive. And it is true, a lot of males are very impulsive, and they get into trouble and fights, and because they don't think or reflect.
They're in a hurry. Yes, yeah. Do you add a point?
Oh, yes, I was saying the yin and yang, the idea of this or that, is kind of being reinterpreted in a lot of science now, and in a lot of just thinking, regular thinking, more as a sliding scale than as an absolute this or an absolute that. Even here in these rooms, we often hear that spirit and matter are one, but different ends of the same pole, which indicates a sliding scale of one or the other. So this idea of we have to make room for the grayscale in between the black and the white. So this idea of this or that isn't perhaps as valid as we like to think it is.
It could be very true when you think about it, because it does take, depending on where your background before you even were introduced to any type of Eastern philosophy, depending your background and what you're coming to this with, can be a real blockage, because a lot of it deals with outside of ourselves, someone, something. Whereas Eastern philosophy deals with the whole. There is no breaking down. There is no divisional in that sense that we see it from the outside. And yet it does contain the whole. It takes time to adjust our way of thinking. The whole idea of space, you know, people start thinking about space, and the idea that there's something that you cannot put an end to. There's something that it doesn't matter whether you put something in or take something out. It's still there. It's so much bigger than a, quote, being. It's bigger, it's broader, it's deeper. That can be a starting point to start thinking about. Yes.
Sometimes these ideas are absolutely impossible to put into words.
True.
And we think that's what makes us so grateful for all these thinkers from the past, because matter is spirit. It is spirit that has taken a sacrificial position in order to be of service to consciousness. Matter is conscious. There's consciousness in the mineral, in the plant, in the animal. There's consciousness in the very air all around us. You know, it is taught in occultism that if we knew how, we could read the entire history of this room just by sitting here and looking at the impression on the walls and on the furniture from all the individuals that have been in this room and expressed themselves. So matter is not what we think it is, and science tells us that. It's really just rapidly moving atoms, and we perceive it. If we step up to the astral plane, and we do every night, what's the matter we're dealing with in dreams? Isn't it as real as this matter, and sometimes even better than this matter? So we know these things, we just can't accept it in our present thinking.
And yes, we know for a fact there are people who in this lifetime have the ability to come in and literally read these walls, read this room, that everything that has been is in this room is in here. And there are those who have the ability to be able to read it. That's not saying that that's what we're here for, but the fact is that everything is not as it seems on this level, and we have to get beyond this basic level. Yes.
You know, I recognize that there are individuals who have this, say, this power to come in and see more than Mr. Judge's picture and the flowers, and the architecture. But even if I knew it resided in me, I feel as though it's not up to me to expand on this, because there's something that tells me, you know, there are more important things to do. For instance, improve my relations with other human beings.
That's a very good point.
And I don't denigrate or put that down. I should imagine the person who can do that has, oh, I don't know, we can't judge, evolved to a higher degree. But I think it's not for me. At this time, anyway.
We weren't bringing it out to say this is what we're here for and what we're to do it for, but the fact for us to understand that most of us cannot give credit to the powers of the germs that we have within ourselves that are already there, these abilities that we might find uncanny for one or stranger for another, the fact we all have these, but because of the way we think, which, and that's very important, because the thought is where it all starts, is the way we act, and the fears that we have, and the joys and the sadness that we have, should be hints to let us understand there's more to life than just this one existence I have. And that's where the idea of the humanity comes in, that unity, that we're all in this together and we're all part of a one. Yes?
On the first page, there's a statement that says neither an object nor a subject to perception. I'm thinking, or I'd like to ask a question for those who neither attempt to see or feel it, but attempt to, but who experience it. And I'm thinking specifically of avatars who have given up all of their personal attributes in order to be absorbed by that which is above them. Do they experience it? Do they have a better understanding of it? Is that what we can expect from advancement?
Well, the fact of the matter is that they can see it for what it really is, where we can't. Ours are colored with our initiatives that we're giving it. Those individuals don't see things the way we. They're probably seeing the real basis.
It's the veil that's spoken of in the park today. It is said that the highest being can only see that veil of Mula property, but by analogy and by their wisdom and experience, they can understand most, as high as they can go.
As high, too. We only have 1 minute.
So taking it down to where we find ourselves today, those gray shades on those poles of opposites are a great analogy, because what we seek is to find the middle and gain balance, not be affected so much by one side or the other.
And as we go into this next week, which is the last one we're going to have for a while, it's going to give us something to think about during the month of August when we don't have it. But this is going to give us more hints and more keys that are needed for us to really understand why we are all. Class is adjourned.